From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. A state of emergency is what Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf calls it. A second coup is what Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid calls it. He says never before in Pakistan's sad history of military rule has a general so reviled invoked martial law to ensure his own survival. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Rashid about the consequences of Musharraf's actions, including why he thinks it will strengthen the Taliban. Rashid is in Madrid today. He's speaking at a couple of conferences in Europe. It's unlikely we'd be able to have this conversation if he was in Pakistan. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Susan Faludi's new book, The Terror Dream, Fear and Fantasy in Post-9/11 America. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After a state of emergency was declared in Pakistan, we got in touch with my guest Ahmed Rashid, a Pakistani journalist who has covered Pakistan, Afghanistan, Central Asia, and Islamic extremism for about 25 years. He's been on our show many times, dating back to the publication of his book Taliban, which became a bestseller after September 11th and introduced many Americans to this extremist group. President Musharraf declared the state of emergency Saturday night. He suspended the country's constitution, fired the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and closed down the judicial system. About 25% of the country's estimated 12,000 lawyers have been placed in jail. Musharraf is the head of the army as well as the president. He was recently re-elected president and promised he would step down as head of the army November 15th. The Supreme Court was expected to rule that he couldn't stay in uniform and remain president. Today, the government released a press release saying the parliamentary election, scheduled for January, would be held as planned. My guest, Ahmed Rashid, is in Madrid now because he's speaking at several terrorism-related conferences in Europe. This morning, he went to a studio there to record an interview with us about his country. Ahmed Rashid, welcome back to Fresh Air. Before we begin our conversation, I want to know, like, if you were in Pakistan instead of visiting Spain where you are now, do you think you'd be able to have the conversation that we're about to have? You've been critical of Musharraf over the years.
Well, I have been very critical, and certainly I think I would be more restrained if I was sitting in Pakistan about my views and what I think has gone wrong and what should happen. The electronic media has been taken off the air completely, something like 35 channels, and the print media is under severe censorship. Now, some of the newspapers are kind of on the edge, as it were, in condemning what has happened. All the media has condemned what has happened. Some has been more muted, some has been quite daring, but it's very risky because it's automatically 3 years in jail for breaking any of these censorship laws, and you would go through a terrorist court. That is a court which would be ruled by army officers.
Do you have friends who are in the media and in jail now?
Well, at the moment, only a couple of journalists have been arrested, and it's not certain what's going to happen to them. But of course, there are an enormous number of people from NGOs, non-governmental groups, women activists, human rights groups. 75 members of the Human Rights Commission of Pakistan have been arrested for nothing more than holding a meeting, a kind of decision-making meeting inside a building, not even holding a protest. Large numbers of women have been arrested, because they have been very vociferously opposed to this. And women, these women include teachers, lawyers, they're not professional politicians. They are just heading or running women NGOs that have been active in promoting education or democracy.
Now, you're a member of the Human Rights Commission, and you said a lot of members of that commission have been arrested. What have you been hearing from colleagues on the commission?
Well, out of about 70 people, 27 were women, many of them very, very good friends of mine. They have been in jail. They were moved from one jail to another. And, you know, you have a quite amazing spectacle now of wives and sisters being in jail and husbands and brothers outside the jail trying to find out how they are and trying to get messages through to them. So it's been very disturbing. Asma Jahangir, who's a UN rapporteur and heads the Human Rights Commission, and she's several times been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. She is under house arrest, and two or three of the very elderly members of the Human Rights Commission have been put into her house, which has now been declared a sub-jail. So her house has become a kind of jail for all anyone over 70 in the Human Rights Commission.
Now, President Musharraf is using the word emergency rule. A lot of people are calling what he's done martial law. You've been describing this as his second coup. Why are you describing it that way?
Well, I'm remembering, you know, the first coup that happened when he replaced the elected Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, replaced him and seized power back in 1999. Now we have what is essentially a second coup in that everything that he himself has built up and allowed to happen, he takes credit for reviving the economy, improving relations with India, allowing cases to go to the Supreme Court, a free press, etc., All that has really been dealt virtually a death blow. He has basically dropped a stone, a very big stone, on his own foot by launching this emergency, because now you have a very acute state of polarization between Musharraf and the army on one side, and on the other you have the judiciary, the media, the political parties, civil society, the NGOs. There's absolutely no support now for him and any kind of future political experimentation that he may want to do.
It's kind of funny to use the word coup when the person who is staging the coup is already in power.
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, this is what is the odd thing. I mean, we've had at least five coups in Pakistan by the military, and they've always had a degree of popularity in that the general was coming in to replace either a prime minister who was corrupt or somebody who was intensely disliked. I mean, this is the first time in history when a sitting general has had to kind of make a coup on himself and on his own policy, as it were, and at a time when he has no political support.
Now, just to summarize, in case people haven't been following it, Musharraf had wanted to run again for president, and at the same time, he was unwilling to give up his position as head of the army. And what was the Supreme Court about to rule on?
Well, Musharraf ran for president. He has been elected as president by the sitting assembly, which is basically against the constitution, because the president should be elected by a new assembly after a general election. Nevertheless, he got himself elected, and there were several petitions that were filed in the Supreme Court saying this was illegal. And as a sop to the Supreme Court, he promised that he would drop his uniform, that is, stop being army chief on November 15th. Now, we still have to see whether he'll do this. This is one of the principal things now that the Americans are demanding that he do, that he ceases being army chief and becomes a civilian president. But he feared, I think, that the Supreme Court was going to rule against him. And he was already in a deeply antagonistic relationship with the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Iftikhar Chaudhry, whom he had sacked 6 months ago. And Iftikhar Chaudhry was then reinstated after 4 months of very violent protests by the entire legal community in Pakistan. And he was reinstated a couple of months ago. And since then, he's delivered a number of judgments which have gone against the military. So people fear that the full bench of the Supreme Court that was hearing these petitions would now rule against Musharraf retaining his second term as president.
You know, the New York Times reported, it was specifically reporters David Rode and Jane Perlez, that a close aide to Musharraf had said that Musharraf had decided to declare a state of an emergency after he was told last week by a Supreme Court justice that the court would rule within days that he was ineligible to serve as president. So this aide said that once Musharraf learned that the court was going to rule unanimously that he was ineligible to serve as president, that's when he declared a state of emergency. Did you hear anything about that?
Yes, I mean, what I have heard is that the decision to declare an emergency was taken several days ago. And in fact, when he spoke to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and the CENTCOM chief, Admiral Fallon, who was in Islamabad just the day before the emergency, it was very clear to the Americans that he had already taken the decision to impose an emergency, and there was very little they could do about it. I think he waited for the weekend for two reasons. One, the Supreme Court would not be in session, so he would be able to grab all the judges at home, which is what happened. And secondly, he hoped that the weekend would deter international criticism, at least until Monday or Tuesday, which was not the case. The international criticism started right the very day of the emergency.
Are most of the Supreme Court justices now under house arrest or in prison?
Well, exactly. I mean, there are 17 judges on the Supreme Court bench. 14 of them refused to take the new oath of office that Musharraf promulgated. And this oath of office would mean that you would have to express loyalty to the president and the chief of army staff, in other words, him. So 14 of these judges refused to take the oath, and they're all under house arrest. 60 out of 97 judges in the four provinces of the country, that is in the High Court, courts of the four provinces also refused to take the oath. And this is unprecedented in Pakistan because traditionally in Pakistan, the judiciary has been, if you like, the handmaiden of the army, in that the judiciary has always validated military coups, it has validated martial laws. Here you have the extraordinary, if you like, maturity now of this new judiciary in just refusing to accept Musharraf's ruling of an emergency, and clearly quite willing to take the consequences. I'm sure there's going to be now enormous harassment of these judges, their families, their businesses, their incomes, of every kind of harassment will now take place.
Lawyers have been at the forefront of protest, and I think this is kind of confusing to a lot of Americans who aren't used to seeing lawyers from the country be at the forefront of political protests as they are in Pakistan now. Would you explain why they are in that position?
Well, you know, the lawyers in Pakistan have always been extremely vocal, extremely political, and always in favor of the rule of law and the constitution. They've very heavily been opposed to military rule. But this year, they, after the Chief Justice was sacked, it was the lawyers that mobilized mass public support for his reinstatement. And the lawyers have been in the forefront now, of course, against the emergency. And I think, you know, what we are seeing now in Pakistan is that the military has really drawn a line between itself and all other state institutions. I mean, the military is not just forcing the judiciary to comply, it is actually trying to subvert and undermine the judiciary. And what that means is that the rule of law, the whole institution of an independent judiciary, the constitution which the judiciary is supposed to uphold, all that has gone out of the window. And I think the lawyers are deeply, deeply concerned about this development, because this harbours very, very bad tidings for the future. How is the next army chief or the next army regime going to reconcile itself with the judiciary now after Musharraf has taken these very harsh measures?
Today, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in Pakistan, who was ousted and I think put under house arrest, managed to speak by phone to a rally in Pakistan. And what were the consequences of that?
They were very severe. The entire mobile telephone network was suspended in the middle of his speech. He was giving a speech on his mobile phone from his house, where he's under arrest, to a rally of lawyers taking place. And in the middle of it, the entire mobile phone network was suspended. And I think, you know, this really demonstrates that, I mean, you don't expect the Chief Justice to be so radical or to take such measures. You expect him to be quietly sitting at home. And this is what any other Pakistani Chief Justice would have done. But this gentleman clearly has taken, you know, the bull by the horns and remains very much part of the struggle.
Do you think that Musharraf will try to appoint new Supreme Court justices or new judges that are willing to swear their loyalty to him?
He's desperately looking for them. He has appointed a new Chief Justice, but he has to immediately fill a bench of the Supreme Court. Now, there's already rumor that he'll never get the 17 judges that make up the bench, and he may in fact declare that the bench will be full if they can just find 7 or 8 judges, which will of course be a huge travesty of justice. But I think it's going to be very difficult. I think no judge, even junior judge, who may be wanting to further his career, is going to take the risk of angering his fellow lawyers and judges and his own family, perhaps, by taking up a position right now under Musharraf.
My guest is Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid, author of the bestseller Taliban. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is journalist Ahmed Rashid. He's Pakistani and has been covering Pakistan and Islamic extremism for many years. He's the author of the best-selling book Taliban. He's currently in Spain, where he's speaking to us from, but intends to go back soon to Pakistan. You wrote this week that the state of emergency declared by President Musharraf will encourage further civil strife, nationwide protests, and greater territorial gains by the extremist Pakistani Taliban. Why do you think that this state of emergency will result in greater gains by the Taliban?
Well, I think the Pakistani Taliban have been very active in the last few weeks. They have seized a lot of territory in northern Pakistan. There has been a very big battle in a very famous valley, the Swat Valley, which is just about 100 kilometers from the capital. And the militants have taken large chunks of territory and have captured troops and killed large numbers of troops. And I think the militants all over the country are going to see a political vacuum at the center, a much weaker army, an army that is now chasing lawyers and women activists that will be preoccupied with the political crisis. And this is the time to strike while the iron is hot.
Well, in fact, Musharraf has been taking the police and intelligence experts from the fight against extremists and using them to control dissidents. I mean, that's exactly what's happening, right?
Exactly. I mean, you know, the fact is that the entire country's police are now mobilized to stop these demonstrations by lawyers and civil society. And the same goes for the intelligence and the army. I think, you know, one thing that the American media has been harping on and has got consistently wrong is that the Bush administration has always kind of posited the dilemmas for countries like Pakistan, Egypt, etc., that should U.S. policy be backing democracy in these countries, or should it be backing a strong authoritarian ruler who will be willing to fight the war on terror? Now, I think this premise is entirely wrong, and the American media has been harping over this in the last few days, and it's also been saying, well, Bush has no choice. He has to support Musharraf because the war on terror is more important. My point is that if you have a country that is deeply unstable, that itself is going through paroxysms of civil strife and instability, how can that country possibly, or that government possibly, be fighting any war against terrorism? And I think that's the real issue. Stability has to come first. I mean, you have to have a stable political system in countries like Pakistan so that they can mobilize the military and the security forces, as well as the public, to support a war on terror.
One of the really frightening things about the instability in Pakistan now is that Pakistan has a nuclear weapon. And it's the only Muslim country to have a nuclear weapon. I'm sure that Al-Qaeda and the Taliban would love to get their hands on it. How worried are you about the nuclear weapon in a time like this?
Well, I think I'm even more worried by the fact that, you know, Pakistan has been, in the past, the largest proliferator of nuclear technology and nuclear materials in the world. It supplied equipment and materials to Iran, to North Korea, and to Libya. And now President Musharraf has stopped all this, but the network that was put in place by Pakistan's leading nuclear scientist, Dr. A.Q. Khan, is, by all accounts of nuclear experts, still very much in place. And of course, it is. It would be relatively easy with this network in place for terrorists, Al-Qaeda, other groups to try and get hold of nuclear materials. So I think that's the first major fear. The second fear is that, you know, what would happen in the army if there's a counter coup against Musharraf? Could there be Islamized officers, Islamic officers at the mid-level, at the colonel or brigadier level, trying to launch a coup in league with some of these extremists outside, the Taliban and other militant groups. So, yes, I mean, there is an enormous fear. But at the moment, certainly, I would say that the nuclear weapons are safe. They are being controlled by the army. There's no access to them by any civilians. And the high command at the moment seems pretty loyal to Musharraf.
What about the rest of the soldiers below the high command? How loyal are they?
Well, I think that's a very good question. I think there are several trends in the army right now. One is that there's an acute demoralization from fighting these militants in the north. Hundreds and hundreds of soldiers have surrendered. At least 700-800 soldiers have surrendered in the last few months to these militants. And I don't mean captured. I mean literally handed over their weapons and surrendered. Now, that has set in a very severe severe demoralization. The second, I think, trend has been professional army officers were really fed up with this kind of high profile the army had. And they were welcoming the idea that with Benazir Bhutto coming back, elections taking place, finally the army could kind of take a back seat and would not be a target of abuse and criticism by the civilians, and could get back to doing its real job of looking after the frontiers and the borders, etc. Now, I think these professional officers are dismayed by what has happened and what Musharraf has done, because he's brought the army back into the firing line and back into the trenches, as it were, the front line against the political classes. And I think the third trend is basically a wave of Islamization that is taking place inside the country is also taking place inside the army. And this, of course, does pose huge dangers.
It certainly seems like the Bush administration is in a really tough spot now. It supported Musharraf with a lot of money, and now Musharraf has basically declared martial law. The Bush administration says that it's for democracy, but how can it be for democracy if it's supporting somebody who's, you know, illegally taken over his country and arrested a lot of the Supreme Court, suspended the Constitution? What do you have to say about the spot that the Bush administration is in now?
Well, I think not only that, they are feeling really betrayed. I think Condi Rice, Mr. Gates, the defense secretary, they have been urging Musharraf not to impose an emergency, go down the route of elections. And he's been reassuring them that he would. And then he does a U-turn. And I think they're feeling very embarrassed, very betrayed. And I think, you know, in the coming days, you will see in Washington questions being raised in Congress, you know, who lost Pakistan? Why did the Bush administration allow Musharraf to betray them so blatantly and embarrass them so blatantly? I think there's a lot of anger now in senior officials in the Bush administration. Frustration, anger, and of course, acute embarrassment.
Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble and the Barnes & Noble Review, the new online literary magazine with reviews, interviews, and recommendations. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. And from PBS, airing tonight, The Story Behind Sputnik on Nova, followed by Frontline, starting at 8, 7 Central on PBS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid on the state of emergency in Pakistan, and Maureen Corrigan reviews Susan Faludi's new book, The Terror Dream, Fear and Fantasy in Post-9/11 America. It's a feminist take on the myths and stories our society grasped hold of for reassurance after the attacks. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid. He's been covering Pakistan, Afghanistan, Central Asia, and Islamic extremism for about 25 years. He's the author of the bestseller, Taliban. He was out of the country when President Musharraf declared the state of emergency Saturday. Rashid is speaking at a couple of conferences in Europe. This morning, he went to a studio in Madrid to record our interview about the crackdown in his country. What do you think are the options that the Bush administration has now? I mean, it's been supporting Musharraf. It's given Musharraf's government $10 billion since September 11th. What are the Bush administration options now?
I think the Bush administration has really demonstrated its weakness and its enormous policy failure. It has had a policy, as Senator Joe Biden said, it's had a Musharraf policy. It's never had a Pakistan policy. And even today, we are seeing the Bush administration still trying to salvage something for Musharraf. I think, you know, this has been wrong on all counts right from the beginning. The problem now is, of course, that Congress is very likely to take the initiative out of the hands of the Bush administration. There's already legislation passed and signed by the president, which would allow Congress to stop aid to Pakistan if it is deemed that Pakistan is not moving forward on democracy. Well, clearly that point has come about now with this emergency. And it's very possible that now Congress will demand that Bush cut aid to Pakistan, or at least some aid, if not all military aid, but some aid to Pakistan. And there's already been the suggestion, for example, that the U.S. stop providing 18 F-16 fighter bombers to Pakistan, which have been ordered and which have nothing to do with the war on terror, but everything to do with building up the forces against India. So there is legislation in place, and it's very likely that the Congress, which is now controlled by the Democrats, and they have been very hostile to Musharraf, will actually force the Bush administration to cut some kind of aid.
Do you think the Bush administration has the power and or the inclination to try to get rid of Musharraf?
Well, I think very much down the road, I think that's what it's going to come to. Because the fact of the matter is that having declared this kind of mini martial law, he's reached a dead end. There's no way now, although he's saying he will hold general elections, there's no way that any general elections under Musharraf are going to have any credibility. Under the kind of draconian rules that we have today, the media has been restricted, political meetings have been restricted, and even if these measures were ended and an election campaign was allowed, the rules of the election set by Musharraf are just not going to be acceptable to the political opposition or to the media. And secondly, even the results of the election will the losers in that election will deem it rigged. So I think really we have reached a dead end with Musharraf. I think there's no way else that he can go except out. This is the real crisis that the international community faces. But I think in the days and weeks ahead, they will have to wake up to this solution, that any kind of lifting of the emergency, moving back to some kind of election and representative government, has to also mean that Musharraf has to go.
Well, the Bush administration has done a lot to keep Musharraf in power. What do you think the Bush administration can do to remove him from power?
Well, I think, you know, obviously the key factor here is going to be the army and the mood in the army and what the army thinks of doing. Now, if these demonstrations spread, especially to the largest province of Punjab, where 60% of the army is recruited from, in fact, about 75% of the army is recruited from Punjab, the army is not going to fire on demonstrators in Punjab if it is ordered to do so. Other martial law administrators have learnt that to their cost. So I think what the big danger is now, that if this confrontation continues, if the army and the police and the security services are forced to clamp down on, you know, middle-class demonstrators, and many of them, you know, are related to army officers themselves. I mean, you know, many families in Pakistan have one brother who's a lawyer and one who's a bureaucrat and another who's in the army. So it's not that these army officers are somehow unrelated to the people that it is trying to crush in the streets. I think then there will be rising dissension in the army. Much depends, first of all, on what Musharraf does on November 15th. Will he relinquish power as army chief and hand it over to his nominated vice chief, General Ishfaq Kiani, or will he continue as army chief?
Where does Benazir Bhutto fit in now? She's the former prime minister of Pakistan. She'd been living in self-exile. She recently returned to Pakistan with the intention of running for prime minister. And the idea is that there be some kind of power-sharing arrangement between her and Musharraf. The United States was a supporter of that. And now, of course, where does this leave her? It leaves her being in the opposition, and she plans on holding a big opposition rally on November 15th, which is the day that Musharraf had promised to step down from his position as head of the military. So what role do you see her as playing now?
Well, I think she's in a very impossible situation. This deal that was brokered by the Americans and the British to some extent, I think what it had failed to do was to really convince Musharraf. I think in retrospect, we can say really that Musharraf never had his heart in the deal and was quite willing to let her come back, but then would sabotage it. And of course, that's what has happened with this emergency. She trusted Musharraf. She came back. She hoped for elections. Only to be confronted by the state of emergency. And now her party is demanding that she join the opposition, denounce Musharraf and ask him to leave politics completely. So far, she's declined. She's still trying to strike a middle path. But the pressure in her party, the pressure from other opposition parties for her now to lead the opposition against Musharraf in defiance of Musharraf is very, very strong. So she is... some of her aides are holding talks with the army and the intelligence services right now. And it has to be seen, you know, if the army is going to offer anything in the sense that, will they give a deadline, for example, for lifting these emergency rules? But if the state of confrontation continues, I think she will have to take the side of the opposition and come out openly against Musharraf.
Now, Al-Qaeda and the Pakistani Taliban don't like Benazir Bhutto. So say she starts to lead the opposition to Musharraf, what position does that put her in with Al-Qaeda and the Pakistani Taliban?
Well, as you said, I mean, Benazir Bhutto and more than that, her party has always traditionally for the last 35 years, it's been anti-army and anti-mullah. The religious parties have never liked the People's Party of Benazir Bhutto. And of course, I mean, that confrontation will be there at the political level. The Taliban, the extremist groups may also try to kill her. They tried to do that in Karachi the day she landed when that massive bombing explosion took place that killed 140 people in her convoy. So clearly she's at enormous risk by the extremists. But at the same time, it must be said that she is, as was demonstrated when she came back in Karachi, she is the only national leader who can command the support of people from all over the country, of all ethnic backgrounds and all religious backgrounds. That is where her importance lies.
Well, what do you think is most likely to happen?
Well, I think it's very difficult to say right now. I mean, things have been very unpredictable in Pakistan. For example, I mean, many people predicted this an emergency, but nobody predicted that Musharraf would take such draconian measures against civil society. Nobody predicted that he would defy the judiciary in the way that he has by arresting the Chief Justice and 14 other judges. So I think the regime itself doesn't know what to do. I mean, we've already seen that, you know, one day they've said, elections will be delayed for a year. The next day they've said, no, they'll be held on time. You know, tomorrow they may say something else. I think the regime itself has been, first of all, taken aback, I think, by the international reaction. They thought they could get away with this somehow. I think, secondly, they've been taken aback by the domestic reaction and the people coming into the streets. They thought that by terrorizing the population, having these draconian measures, it would keep people in their houses and prevent people coming out. Well, it hasn't. And consequently, the regime has had to take very harsh steps to arrest and, beat up people, as it were. Now, I think, you know, the situation remains very, very unpredictable. If he tries to have elections, I think they will be denounced by all the opposition. And it has to be seen if Benazir would denounce them too. If he doesn't have elections, well, then he'll be denounced anyway, because he will then be called a dictator and usurper of political rights, etc. So, I mean, he's in a totally no-win situation.
My guest is Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid, author of the bestseller Taliban. He was in Europe for a couple of conferences when President Musharraf declared the state of emergency. Rashid is speaking to us from a studio in Madrid. The tribal areas on the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan have been a home for the Pakistani Taliban, the Afghani Taliban, and Al-Qaeda. And you've described that as becoming like this, you know, a Muslim extremist state with its own rule of law. So what are the implications for Afghanistan's security now that Pakistan is under a state of emergency and is so unstable?
I fear that the risks in Afghanistan are going to increase enormously, because not only will we have the Pakistani Taliban launching more offensives in Pakistan, but this is a very good opportunity for the Afghan Taliban to do the same there. In fact, this week we've seen the western province of Farha has almost entirely fallen to the Taliban, and the Italian NATO forces there have been unable to push them out. And we are now in the midst of a very harsh winter in Afghanistan. The Taliban traditionally never fight in winter, but this winter it seems that they're going to continue fighting throughout the coming months. And I think they will be hugely bolstered by what they see as two very weak governments in the region. The government in Kabul, that is weak for other reasons, and of course the vacuum that is being created in Pakistan, which will allow their brothers in arms in Pakistan to expand their area of influence.
Are the Afghani Taliban trying to retake the country?
Oh, I think there's no doubt about it. I mean, they're certainly trying to reconquer southern and western Afghanistan. They don't have support in the north. The ethnic groups in the north are very much opposed to the Taliban. But we saw last week in Kandahar, the second largest city in the country, some 800 Taliban had massed outside Kandahar and were trying to infiltrate the city. And they were pushed back by the Canadians in a battle that lasted almost a week. So, we are seeing huge advances. We're seeing large-scale brigade-size movement of Taliban inside the country. And a lot of this, their logistics and support comes from their fellow Taliban and Al-Qaeda who are active in Pakistan. So this is a mutually reinforcing movement. They each reinforce each other and support each other. So if you have a vacuum in both states, I think, and a weak government in both states, I think this is really going to make things much, much worse in Afghanistan.
So do you think that the Taliban have their sights set not just on Afghanistan, but also on Pakistan? Like, how serious are they about trying to take over parts or all of Pakistan?
Well, you know, the Taliban in the 90s were this very kind of, if you like, extremist but still nationalist force. Now, I think the Afghan Taliban leadership has been very heavily influenced by Al-Qaeda and the whole philosophy of global jihad. And we've seen the emergence of Pakistani Taliban. I think the next stage we will see the emergence of Central Asian Taliban and Caucasian and Chechen Taliban. I think you will see this influence of the Taliban spreading as they take on not just the Afghan regime, but regimes in the entire region. I think the Taliban really now believe that they are an ideological force. They're a force for good. They're a part of Al-Qaeda. They have a tested regime system, if you like. And they're very keen to expand.
Meanwhile, you know, India and Pakistan have had a very difficult relationship. They both have nuclear weapons. So what does the state of emergency and the instability in Pakistan mean for the relationship between India and Pakistan?
I think, you know, this really reflects very sadly on Musharraf's legacy. I mean, he over the last 3 years, he had brokered a series of peace agreements with India. The tensions had cooled down considerably. And by all accounts, I mean, this would be one of his greatest legacies. Here was a military ruler who had invaded, in fact, a part of Indian Kashmir in 1999 and 4 years later made peace with India. India. This would have gone down in the history books as being, you know, as a big plus mark for him. And I think he's just going to destroy this legacy now, because India has halted all negotiations with Pakistan until the situation stabilizes. And so a lot of trade and drug control and the coming and going and visa regulations, etc., all these, you know, talks on a myriad of issues have all been halted for the last 3 or 4 months because of the political crisis in Pakistan.
You are trying to figure out when to go back to Pakistan. As we said earlier, you're currently in Madrid because you have some business in Europe. I hate to put it this way, but it seems to me if you return to Pakistan, you have two opportunities to be arrested. One, as a journalist who's been very critical of Musharraf, as we've heard in this interview. And two, you're a member of the Human Rights Commission, and a lot of members of that commission are under house arrest now. So how safe would it be for you to return?
I have no idea. I mean, to tell you the truth, I really have no idea as to, you know, what the situation has been. So far, at least, the print media, which is certainly publishing, only a couple of journalists have been arrested from there. And they were arrested largely because they were demonstrating with the lawyers rather than for anything that they've written. But we have to see what happens. Again, this is very unpredictable. I mean, if the protests increase by the lawyers and by other groups, and the newspapers continue reporting these and continue writing very negatively about Musharraf and the emergency, we may see arrests of journalists. So far, I think the regime itself, I mean, they've taken the electronic media off the air, but so far they have not indulged in mass arrests of journalists. So I'm trusting that that will continue.
Let me ask you to just get a little personal for a second. Your concerns as a Pakistani person, not even as a journalist now, just as a person, your concerns about the future of your country.
Well, quite honestly, Terry, I mean, it has been an incredibly depressing time. I was at a conference in Germany on terrorism when this happened. I'm going to another conference in Stockholm tomorrow on Afghanistan, where I'll be speaking. And it's very difficult to concentrate on anything else apart from what's been happening in Pakistan. And I really do fear now that the polarization between the military and civil society and the other institutions of state are so acute right now that it's going to require a real wizard, a real healer, if you like, as the next army chief to come in and heal this rift. And secondly, I think the really big fear is that the extremists are going to gain enormous amount of ground in this period. We as a country, we have no time left. We have to combat this extremism on our own, for our own sakes, not for the sake of the Americans or for anyone else. And I think that the problem in Pakistan right now is there's a lot of confusion. People consider an anti-extremist position as being somehow pro-American. What you need are genuine elected leaders who can educate the people, which is something Musharraf utterly failed to do. You need leaders who can educate the people that, you know, we have to fight this extremist virus for our own sakes, for our children's sakes, not because, you know, Bush is ordering us to do it. And unfortunately, this confusion is very widespread in Pakistan.
Well, Ahmed Rashid, I want to thank you for talking with us. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. And I wish you, you know, good luck and safe travel in what is, I know, a very difficult time for you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Ahmed Rashid is a Pakistani journalist and author of the books Taliban and Jihad. He spoke to us from Madrid. Our interview was recorded this morning. Coming up, a feminist take on stories and myths Americans grasped after 9/11. Maureen Corrigan reviews Susan Faludi's new book. This is Fresh Air. Culture critic Susan Faludi writes about the gender wars in America. Her books Backlash and Stiffed have sparked admiration and controversy. Her latest book, The Terror Dream, is already generating much of the same critical reaction. The Terror Dream investigates America's response to 9/11 in terms of the myths and stories our society grasped hold of for reassurance after the attacks. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
In perilous times, lots of folks are willing to jump feet first into whatever shelter is available, whether it's a literal one sealed with duct tape or a psychological one constructed out of reassuring stories. But a few curious or just plain contrary souls always remain standing above ground, trying to get a clearer view of what's happening. Susan Faludi is one of those daredevils, albeit an intellectual one. As a culture critic, she's never been content to duck and cover. Certainly, Faludi's new book, called The Terror Dream, is guaranteed to rain down a whole lot of trouble onto her head. Among the audience already or likely to be angered by it are conservatives, the mainstream media, and bipartisan fans of the John Ford classic, The Searchers. What drew Faludi into writing yet another controversial book were the phone calls she received immediately after 9/11 from reporters pursuing reaction stories. As Faludi recalls, the first of those reporters to interview her wound up answering his own questions about the social effect of the attacks when he gleefully exclaimed, "Well, this sure pushes feminism off the map." What followed was an avalanche of soft news stories proclaiming reactionary trends like a return to nesting, the resurgence of both the manly man and the feminine, read less feminist, woman, and the displacement of soccer moms by security moms, obsessed with fencing in hearth and home and electing a presidential Matt Dillon to do so. Why, Faludi wondered, did the women's movement after 9/11 become framed as not just a domestic annoyance, but a declared domestic enemy, a fifth column in the war on terror? Her answer in part two of The Terror Dream is startling. Faludi delves into the earliest chronicles of our country to point out that, far from being unthinkable, an attack on civilian targets on our soil by dark-skinned, non-Christian combatants fighting under the flag of no recognized nation was in fact the characteristic and formative American ordeal. What she's talking about is the war on terror fought for hundreds of years by white settlers against Native Americans. Faludi examines captivity narratives in which white women told their story of abduction by Native Americans. More importantly, she scrutinizes how these captivity narratives were culturally rewritten over the span of 300 years so that real-life women who were not saved or who saved themselves or who chose to remain with their Indian captors were transformed into helpless victims, always awaiting an all-powerful Daniel Boone or John Wayne to deliver them. The post-9/11 tale of Army Private Jessica Lynch, Faludi says, is a contemporary example of this kind of revised captivity narrative. Blonde, doll-like, and allegedly abused by her captors, Lynch was rescued from an Iraqi hospital by an assault force of Navy SEALs, Army Rangers, Air Force pilots, and Marines, among others. It was the feel-good war story everybody wanted. Except, as Lynch herself protested, it wasn't true. The rescue mission was overblown. She said she wasn't abused and insisted that the real heroine of the whole episode was her fallen comrade in arms, Lori Piesteva, hailed as self-reliant and tough. Other narratives of 9/11 that Faludi investigates with her characteristic restraint and depth of research are the saga of Flight 93, scant on facts and again overladen with tales of heroic men, as well as the supersized image of the New York City fireman, often paired, she says, with a contemptuous slap to feminists who've attempted to soften up such real men for the past three decades. Faludi's aim here is not, of course, to take away from the genuine heroism exhibited by men and women on 9/11 and beyond, but to investigate the peculiarly American response to the attacks, in which the media and politicians across the spectrum reach for an age-old myth of American invincibility, which required the accompanying mirage of womanly dependency and a family circle in need of protection from a menacing outside world. Faludi's detractors are already chipping away at her provocative thesis by citing Hillary Clinton's bid for the presidency, Katie Couric's elevation to CBS anchorwoman, Harvard's female president, but they don't do justice to her crucial insight. America can have the kind of reactionary gender politics Faludi sees post 9/11 and simultaneously witness major cultural gains for women. Faludi here has once again described the pushback, the demand to retain the straitjacketed roles that tell us what a man and a woman should be. With a rigorous insistence on truth, not comforting stories, Faludi proposes we can still awaken from the terror dream to what one prescient man of the 60s, in a mixed metaphor for the ages, called the chimes of freedom flashing.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Terror Dream by Susan Faludi. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Senior Producer is Roberta Shurrock. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery. Five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont. On the web at go.coop. From the Caddo Charitable Foundation, supporting the National Parks Conservation Association, whose report on the effects of global warming in national parks can be found at npca.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
When he was a child, Percy Carey, a.k.a. M.F. Grimm, was a regular on Sesame Street. When he grew up, he became a hip-hop performer and drug dealer. A murder attempt left him in a wheelchair. A narcotics conviction put him in prison. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with him about his life and how he's changed it. He's written a graphic memoir. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Never do me wrong, or the best for me, she was a beautiful soul.